You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Later on, we talk with Merrill Gordon about fashion icon Bunny Melon. But first, we talk about Rolling Stone magazine with Joe Hagan. Joe Hagan is a journalist who's contributed to Rolling Stone, the Wall Street Journal, and lots of other places. His new book is Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine. Joe Hagan, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
The book, it's not just the life of Jan Wenner or the story of his magazine. It's really a book about the last 50 years of American popular culture and politics.
Absolutely. It's a cultural history. And it's really a history of, you know, the times that a lot of us just came out of into this new century. You know, how we got from the late 60s, you know, baby boom culture, that whole renaissance of the rock and roll age, you know, through the wild 70s, the Reagan 80s and onward. And here's one man who was sort of in his magazine in this sort of cosmology of rock stars and celebrities that you've heard of, who are kind of at the center of building a lot of that and defining what the culture was going to mean for a lot of people. And so, you know, Jan Wenner, who a lot of people haven't even heard of, was a gatekeeper, you know, an arbiter of culture and very powerful for a long time.
Yeah, so in Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone magazine, you explain how Jan Wenner basically hired you to write the book.
He did, yeah. Well, he didn't hire me. He asked me to write it. And I'd written a couple of things for him. I got to know him in a real casual social way because we live not too far from each other, or he has a house near where I live in New York State. And one day over lunch, he asked me to write it. I was, of course, flattered by the prospect of it and daunted. It's a huge life that this man has lived. But he himself is also a very complicated guy, you know, known for being kind of irascible and, you know, difficult sometimes. And so it was something of a negotiation to figure out how I would do it. And the main thing for me was doing it independently, making sure the book had, you know, credibility and objectivity. And we got to a point where that was able to happen. And I had access to him and his archive and this whole world of rock stars, who many of whom I interviewed and, you know, wrote the story that kind of came out of the reporting.
Okay, so how did Jan Wenner, I mean, he must have read the book, and what does he think?
Well, that's it can now be said that he despises the book and doesn't like it at all. He's washed his hands of it, distanced himself from it. He did, you know, part of the deal I had with him is he couldn't read it or edit it or have any kind of control over it until it was done. And that was my sort of, at the outset, was my key demand. Because I just realized with a guy like this, or any powerful person really, you have to be able to tell the story, you know, as you find it. And so I did, and I sent him the book after it was already in the printing plant. I sent it to him after Labor Day this year, and radio silence ensued, and then soon I learned that he was very upset with it. And, you know, he called it tawdry and various other things.
So has he tried to stop it or done anything like that?
No. We were actually scheduled to have an event together, and, you know, he had sort of nominally agreed to try to, you know, he was going to promote it in some way, perhaps, and all of that stopped. He canceled the event we were going to be at, and he put pressure on other people to distance themselves from me, and he just basically, you know, washed his hands of the whole thing. And then concurrently, he produced a documentary on HBO that people may have seen in the news, but you know, it was a very different version of his life and story, and much more kind of, you know, reverent and self-congratulatory and all the things you might expect, because he was the executive producer. So, but my book is a much more raw, kind of straight accounting of his life and all of this kind of, you know, this very messy, complicated, but extremely fun world of rock and roll that he came out of.
Did you, I'm sure you've seen the HBO thing, so are there any inaccuracies from your research point of view?
Not really, just a lot of omissions. I mean, you know, the story of his relationship with John Lennon, You know, he had this very famous interview with John Lennon after the Beatles broke up that ran over two issues of Rolling Stone magazine in 1971. And it was a really kind of, you know, very powerful, probably one of the greatest celebrity interviews of the late 20th century. It was John Lennon pouring his guts out about his life in the Beatles. And John Lennon had been very important to Rolling Stone. He was on the first cover, of course, and he was, you know, the magazine was sort of built on his image. And what the documentary leaves out is that after Jan published this famous interview, he decided he was going to publish it as a book as well. And John Lennon told Jan in Rolling Stone, no, that's my interview. We agreed in a handshake deal that I owned the interview. You could publish it once, and that would be the end of it. And Jan published it anyway, against his will, as a book entitled Lennon Remembers. And John Lennon never spoke to Jan again. He was so angry about the interview being published as a book, and forever after referred to it as Lennon Regrets. And so, you know, Jan burned that bridge almost as soon as he built it. And that's, you know, one of the things you won't find out on HBO.
That was a foolish bridge to burn, I would think. I mean, I think you could get a lot out of having a good relationship with John Lennon than you could out of publishing that book.
Yeah, well, you know, in the book, Jan concedes that it was an error. And he had just come out, the magazine had just come out of a period of, like, almost financial ruin. And I think he had developed a, you know, renewed interest in being profitable. And also the Beatles were over. And so in his mind, he may have figured, well, the rock and roll era after the famous Altamont concert of December 1969, which was considered sort of like, you know, the end of the 60s, right? And he may have figured in his calculus that the Beatles were, you know, not going to be the central story for him anymore since they were breaking up. And he had also begun to take more interest in the new journalism that was coming out at the time, and he had befriended Hunter S. Thompson, and that was his new kind of obsession and love, right? And in a way, Hunter replaces John Lennon as the kind of muse of Jan's, you know, vision of the world. And so it's all very, you know, this built into the history of Rolling Stone and the culture and this man are all these soap operas, you know, of the relationships between this gatekeeper of rock and roll and Rolling Stone at Rolling Stone magazine and these famous rock stars everybody knows about.
It's also interesting how Rolling Stone magazine it not only influenced the taste of rock and roll consumers like me, but also influenced us in both directions, told us what to listen to and told us what not to listen to, that it wasn't cool to like, you know, Led Zeppelin, for instance, even though Led Zeppelin were a towering giant. They weren't a towering giant to people who read Rolling Stone. They were a towering giant to people who read Cream.
That's right. Well, and, you know, Rolling Stone over the years, you know, the accumulation of all of their editorial judgments and critical judgments began to form kind of a worldview, you know, about rock and roll. And the truth is that the success of Rolling Stone as an enterprise, as a business, they won the contest about who gets to define what people think about a lot of different kinds of music, you know, because they survived, you know. And then over the years, you get Rolling Stone publishing all these record guides, right? And then they would publish this, that, and the other thing, and they began to form a real, you know, it had a more historical impact, their success. But the Led Zeppelin stuff, you know, the eventually the magazine comes around to all that classic rock, you know. But in the 70s, the critical apparatus at Rolling Stone, like, a lot of these guys were, you know, from the 60s, had been there from the beginning, and they, when something new came along like Led Zeppelin, they were skeptical of it. They thought, oh, this is just a, you know, cynical supergroup of some kind who's just, you know, doesn't mean it. That was their sort of feeling. And that it was this, it had this kind of hard rock working class thing that Jan Winter never liked personally. You know, there was a little bit of a class judgment about some of that music. But, you know, you couldn't argue with the fact that Led Zeppelin sold a lot of records and everybody loved them. And the way that you kind of the thing that was great about Rolling Stone and about, you know, covering that world was that in the letters column at Rolling Stone, you would get all of the acrimony and talk back from the readers. and there was a sense of a dialogue going on. You know, what made magazines great, what made Rolling Stone powerful and successful, was that Jan Wenner understood that this was all about passion. You know, that rock and roll, he was passionate about rock and roll at the start, but that his his readers were fans. They loved this stuff. They would read anything, you know, that Pete Townsend said. So if you had 10 pages of Pete Townsend, well, then you had them, you know. And that was a real powerful thing. It didn't matter, you know, even if they published a review that you hated, you would keep reading because you were just, inspired, whether positively or negatively.
They were snobs.
Yeah, they were snobs. Well, that was their job. I mean, you know, people read it because they wanted to find out what Grill Marcus was going to say. You know, what? Because they figure, you know, these are sort of college graduates from Berkeley who are using the same kind of critical faculties they might use to write a dissertation on, name your poet and Ezra Pound or something. But now they're applying it to, you know, the Steve Miller Band. So it was like a whole new way of thinking about this music. And what was powerful about it to people was that they took it seriously, and they made it people. It gave it credibility, whether you liked it or didn't like it.
Rolling Stone published a encyclopedia of rock and roll, an illustrated encyclopedia, and it was like a big red. I'm talking about the first printing of it. It was a great big oversized red book.
Yeah.
And Lester Bangs wrote a piece about the Doors, an entry in this so-called encyclopedia, in which the only door he mentions is Jim Morrison, and he slams him.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that was also part of the Rolling Stone worldview, especially in the late 60s, early 70s, which was that they were a San Francisco magazine, and they considered L.A. and a lot of the groups out of L.A. to be phony. And, you know, Jim Morrison fit the bill to a T because he was pretentious, right? He had no sense of humor in their mind. So, he was fair game, and kind of that washed over into a lot of other groups too. Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. A lot of these groups got bad press in Rolling Stone early on because there was a bias there built into the kind of San Francisco versus L.A. Worldview.
One of the saddest things that happened to Rolling Stone over the years is the magazine itself. I mean, it's fared better than, say, Crawdaddy, but at the same time, it has less and less about music and more about, and this was happening, you know, right into the 70s, sexy pictures. The sexiest person got on the cover, and they started that hot issue, which is like the swimsuit issue.
Sure.
And the music is, articles about music are now the last three pages of the magazine.
Yes. Well, that was the evolution of the culture into a new age of celebrity making. At the beginning, in the late 60s, Rolling Stones, you would find the rock stars, the kind of treatment of them was as sort of countercultural figures in an underground. But as Rolling Stone and the whole kind of youth culture metastasized, and as you get into the early 70s, you've got these young people taking over the levers of power in Hollywood. You've got Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson and these young kind of, rebels who are going to try to make their own movies, and they're getting into politics. And as Rolling Stone captured that and helped redefine these same 60s figures as celebrities, they used their new value system, which was, we're not going to be uptight anymore, so you can take off all your clothes and be sexy. And somehow sex and the kind of honesty of it, as captured by Annie Leibovitz, especially in the early years, was a signifier of authenticity. That meant you were authentic, that you were the real deal, because you would take it all off for Rolling Stone and kind of preen on the cover. And this redefined what celebrity meant. Now, today, you barely blink at it. It's built into the culture. It's baked into what everybody knows is true. But back then, it was radical, you know, to see stuff like this on the cover. Because if you'd gone 10 years before, you would have seen very little of that, of youth figures acting like this in magazines, saying the kind of things that John Lennon said in that interview, like that level of confession, that level of kind of, dropping cuss words and speaking very frankly and talking about his therapy and all these other things. I mean, this was all novel at the time, and over time it became institutionalized as a way of selling products, and Rolling Stone helped make that happen.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Joe Hagan. He's the author of Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine. Joe Hagan, Rolling Stone Magazine was essential reading.
There were iterations of it in unsuccessful magazines. I mean, the thing that made Rolling Stone have definition for people was that it was successful. And lots of people got their hands on it and read it. And the reason it was successful was because it took things that people didn't have access to. These rock stars, that world out of San Francisco that came out of the late 60s with all that wonderful hippie counterculture of the Haight-Ashbury. And it created a window into that world, into a world that you couldn't get anywhere else. You know, there was Random Notes, which was the gossip column, basically. And it would tell you all the inside dope of what was going on inside the record business with your favorite rock stars, what kind of record deals were going on, who was dating who. You know, this was really powerful, attractive, fantastic stuff to get. And if you were out in the Midwest somewhere, you weren't going to get this anywhere else. And that was, partly what made it was successful editorially, because it was really well done and had all these incredible talents, like Annie Leibovitz's photography, Hunter S. Thompson. Eventually, Jan's success allowed him to get people like Tom Wolfe into the magazine and give it really mainstream credibility. And he would connect you with the youth audience. And this is sort of like feedback loop going on between, the people that wanted to be in with that world. And it became not just rock stars. It became actors, politicians, by the time you get to 72, you've got George McGovern wants to kind of co-opt this audience too, and he, shacks up with Rolling Stone, and they sort of transact him, And this sort of evolution is what was so exciting about it in the 70s, where you were watching it in real time every other week in the magazine. You were watching this youth culture as it kind of expanded and took power, and by the late 70s, it's moved straight into the mainstream. It is the establishment. And Jan Wenner was saying this, in newspaper interviews in the late 70s, we are the establishment now. Rock and roll is the establishment. And he saw that at the beginning. That was the vision that he had.
So it seems that the saddest character in your book is Jane Wenner.
Yeah. Well, she's she had never really given really any interviews, or very few, over the years. And nobody knew who she was, what her role in the success of Rolling Stone was, and that was a really important kind of narrative through line for me to explore in this book, and especially given that Jan was gay and in the closet for 26 or 7 years, and she, her family put up a lot of the money to start Rolling Stone in 1967, so you have this very kind of complicated, fraught relationship, and she ends up kind of suffering the wages of their success more than he does. You know, he's able to live any way he wants, but their marriage is always a little troubled, not only by how kind of decadent the whole rock and roll lifestyle was, but also by the fact that Jan was, privately gay. So she ends up being this, but at the same time, she was very important to their social world, and their social world was how they attracted and brought in people into the magazine, whether rock stars or new actors or new writers or whatever. They would all go into Jan and Jane's little social world, which the center of which was this beautiful Victorian house in San Francisco on California Street in the 70s, and it was sort of the site of all this wonderful kind of rock and roll decadence and interaction and commingling, and it's kind of where, so Jane was the salon host of their private world, and a lot of the people that were in their lives were very much attracted to her and closer to her than they were to Jan. And she helped repair a lot of relationships that he had hurt or kept people on the reservation, talents like Annie Leibovitz and Hunter S. Thompson. When they were fed up with Jan, they would go to Jane Winter. So she was sort of the, an important but difficult to quantify power in their world and in the success of the magazine.
And what does she do now? Where is she now?
She lives in, Greenwich Village, and she lives alone. She's, has friends and everything, but she's a very kind of private woman, but very, she's a very complicated and nervous woman.
Is there a future for Rolling Stone?
Well, it's on the block right now. They're trying to sell it, and we've heard in different newspaper columns that there are different buyers out there who are interested. We haven't heard whether the shoe has dropped yet. I don't believe it has, but, it's hard to imagine Rolling Stone having a life beyond Jan Winter, who was the founder and kind of for whom it was the expression of his entire worldview. It was his whole identity, his like social calendar and his yearbook and everything you can imagine. It was really deeply connected with him. So when it's not connected with him and it's sold off to somebody else, what it becomes is anybody's guess. But as a brand, it would be hard to argue that it's relevant to anybody under 35 years old. In the last 10 or 15 years, the sort of double whammy that Jan Winter was contending with was that the magazine business was in decline, but so was the music business. And, within the music business, rock and roll was even more in decline as a relevant musical genre, that's where we've arrived here 50 years on. But, 50 years is a long time for a magazine to exist.
That's true. Yeah. I think the internet has rendered music criticism kind of meaningless, even though, informed criticism is a great thing. But since everybody can be a music critic,
And everybody is, and some of them are good, and they don't have, they don't even need a platform, or like a traditional platform. You can just write whatever you want. Yeah, and musical criticism was more relevant when rock and roll was just fresh out of the gate, and people were critiquing it because they considered it to be so important. It was so central to the lives of the people who were listening to it. Music is still central to some people's lives and to some young people's lives, but it's not like as defining of young people's entire world. It's not like the artists are expressing everything about who they want to be and what they think about, everything from love to war. It's not that the artists aren't expressing it, but it's not as central to the youth culture anymore. I'm talking specifically about rock and roll.
It really is a fascinating history of the 20th, the latter half of the 20th and into the 21st century. It's called Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Winter and Rolling Stone Magazine. And the author, my guest, Joe Hagan, thanks so much for spending some time talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Journalist Joe Hagan, author of Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Winter and Rolling Stone Magazine. My next guest tonight is Merrill Gordon. Merrill Gordon, in addition to being a regular contributor to Vanity Fair and teaching journalism at NYU, is the author of a few bestsellers, Mrs. Astor Regrets, The Phantom of Fifth Avenue, and her latest, Bunny Mellon, The Life of an American Style Legend. Merrill Gordon, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I really enjoyed your new book. I have to say that I had never heard of Bunny Mellon before I read the book, although, I should have. I mean, she lived a remarkable and long life among the rich and powerful, and among other things, she built the White House Rose Garden, or rebuilt it, I guess. But you came to know her.
This was a very unusual and kind of lucky experience for me. I'm a nice middle class Jewish girl from Rochester, New York. So the whole high society beat is really not the world I grew up in. But my books have evolved out of newsy stories, and my first was about Brooke Astor, 105-year-old from the Social Register. My second was about Huguette Clark. So I've become known as the person who writes these interesting books about women who are in the news, usually involved with some kind of scandal. And that's how I came to Bunny Mellon. Newsweek asked me to write a story about her, It was the summer of 2011. She had just given a lot of money to John Edwards, the disgraced Democratic presidential candidate. She'd been interviewed by the FBI. He'd been indicted for illegal campaign contributions. And I was asked to talk to her, and I never, ever thought she would speak to me. But I have learned from my previous books that if you write letters on beautiful monogram stationery and send them off, people often responded. And she, Bonnie Mellon, called me. And much to my amazement, I got an interview, and she liked the story, and we talked one or two more times. And she told her family that she liked the story. So after she died, I was invited to her funeral, and her grandson, Thomas Lloyd, said, "We would love it if you would be interested in writing the book." But what was even better about this is this was not an authorized book, and that there was no, there was no legal agreement. They gave me tremendous access to her letters, her diaries, her journals, her files. I interviewed 175 people, but nobody told me what I could or couldn't write. So it was an amazing freedom to have to write a book.
So I imagine that you knew who she was, you know, before she was involved in this scandal, because you had already done research into this era.
You know, she was one of those names that kind of kept popping up of, you know, important, interesting, and very private women of this era. And I'd always heard about her as the best friend to Jackie Kennedy, which was kind of the role that she played for many years. And Bunny didn't like the limelight, so she deliberately kept a low profile. So it was really fun to be able to kind of figure out who was the woman behind this kind of famous famous name.
Well, I really did enjoy the book, and it was like, you know, it's like kind of like time traveling into a completely different world. And I, one of the things that I loved is that the invention of the word halitosis led to her led to her fortune.
Her family's fortune, yes. Her grandfather, Jordan Lambert, was from Virginia, pharmacist, and he went to St. Louis. And he got the brilliant idea to license this brand new formula that had been invented to as a kind of surgical dressing solution. And it was named after Dr. Joseph Lister, who was a famous British surgeon. And for many years, this was sold primarily to doctors and dentists. And then when there was a sales lull, Bunny Millen's father, Gerard Lambert, who had had a financial reversal, went back to work for the family firm, and they were trying to figure out how could they expand sales. And somebody at the company said, "You know, I always heard it was good for bad breath." And then he said, "You know, the word for, you know, Latin word for bad breath is halitosis." So suddenly, Gerard Lambert had this brilliant advertising idea and ran all of these, came up with all these ads about, they're called kind of Hall of Shame ads. They were all about, you know, her best friend wouldn't tell her, and always a bridesmaid but never a bride, about all these people who had terrible breath, but nobody would tell them. And that that took off. I mean, sales just completely soared, and that's how Bunny came to, you know, she led a very wealthy young life.
Well, Merrill Gordon, Bunny Mellon was really a trendsetting gardener and landscape designer and a style icon. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, well, she had been fascinated as a child by gardens, and the Olmsted brothers, whose father, Frederick Law Olmsted, had designed Central Park and many of the monuments in Washington, his sons designed her father's garden in Princeton, New Jersey. And she was always fascinated by gardens, always had her own little gardens, and gardens were her great passion. Her second marriage was to Paul Mellon. Paul Mellon's father was Andrew Mellon, Treasury Secretary under three different presidents, helped create this massive Mellon fortune of, you know, coal and mining and et cetera. And so Bunny married very, very well the second time. And suddenly she was thrust into a very different world. Her first husband had been a newspaper publisher of in Virginia, from sort of equestrian magazine. But now Bunny is entertaining the Queen of England. She's, you know, there's a private plane. She's building homes in Antigua and Cape Cod. And then she becomes friends with the Kennedys. And once JFK was elected, she commuted to the White House. One of the things that was really touching about this book was I got to read a number of Jackie Kennedy's letters to Bunny. And they were letters like, you know, "Everyone else wants to be my friend," Jackie was writing, "to be in the spotlight, but you hate the spotlight, and I'm so afraid that you'll fade away, and I need you." And it was just so touching to sort of see how important that friendship was to one another. But Bunny helped redecorate the White House. She helped plan some late dinners. She did the flowers. And when JFK was assassinated, Jackie asked Bunny to do the flowers at the rotunda, at the church, and at the at Arlington Cemetery, which was something the civilian had never been asked to do.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Continuing our conversation now with Merrill Gordon. She's the author of Bunny Mellon, The Life of an American Style Legend.
She had an incredible sense of taste. I mean, I don't know about you, but it's not that I don't care about my surroundings, but I don't notice every little tiny thing. But Bunny had this pursuit of perfection. She had a real sense of how everything should look. I mean, one of the fun things in writing this book was the hilarious stories people told about her. You know, she had her staff serve Lay's potato chips, but they had to take out the broken pieces, which I thought was kind of amusing. She put in a pool of Cape Cod, but then she decided that the shallow end should be where the deep end was, so she made them take it out and do it all over again. I mean, there was this whole, like, vision for how things should be, and she had unlimited amounts of money, so she was willing to, you know, do whatever it took to get the thing that she wanted.
That's, you know, sort of the craziest thing when you're reading it is, like, the unlimited amount of money to do anything you want.
Well, you know, this is my third book about a very wealthy family, and obviously all of us would love to have these kinds of resources. On the other hand, you do start to come to feel that there are emotional patterns that aren't necessarily terribly healthy. I mean, I think that, you know, if you never have to, if you have so much money that many people are interested in you because of your money, you never really know who loves you for yourself. I think it can really distort relationships. Money becomes a power chip, you know. Bunny, one of the sadder things was she was not kind to her children and one of her grandchildren, and she also cut off a lot of her friends. Or people who thought they were her friends. I mean, I read these letters that were very kind of poignant. But I think she was also very insecure, and there was a certain amount of dropping people before they dropped her and really wondering, you know, why do you love me? I mean, the auction at Sotheby's was kind of jaw-dropping just because she had so much stuff. I mean, it was kind of floor after floor after floor. I mean, there weren't two or three porcelain cabbages. There were probably 30. I mean, the amount of pure possessions. And there were a couple of people who said she shopped almost obsessively. She kind of, it was a way of filling, you know, a hole in her life. And that struck me as being sad.
Do you think, you know, since you've written about so many people in this realm, do you think that's a common thing among rich people, that they drop their friends, that they will find some very, very small thing that they will view as disloyalty and then just, like, cut their friends off and never speak to them again?
Well, I feel like I can't generalize about an entire social class and set, but I don't know. Not entirely my world, but I do think that having that kind of money makes you not feel like you need to compromise, that people need to do what you want. And it was also Bunny's father was like that, and very much of kind of, you know, he wanted what he wanted. On the other hand, both Bunny and her husband, Paul Mellon, were capable of great acts of kindness to a lot of people who worked for them, a lot of their friends. People were in trouble. They, you know, they put kids through college. They really helped out. So that they were also, I mean, there were remarkable acts of generosity. And the other thing I should say about Bunny's taste, it has lived on in a couple of different ways, one of which is the rose garden she designed is still the rose garden that we see today, and that every president in recent memory, who, you know, if they give a press conference in the rose garden, if they have a ceremony in the rose garden, that's Bunny's design, and they're still using it. The other thing is, when she met her husband, Paul Mellon, the great art collector, he had primarily been interested in British paintings, a lot of dogs and horses, Stubbs, Turners, wonderful paintings, but kind of a narrow range. And Bunny introduced him to the Impressionists, and they bought hundreds and hundreds of paintings, most of which they donated to either the National Gallery of Art or the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts in Richmond. And it's interesting, because one of the things that made me want to do the book was, in the National Gallery of Art, it's all Mr. and Mrs. Paul Mellon. It it's like Bunny is invisible, and I kind of wanted to, you know, and particularly since it was her eye, I kind of wanted to help bring her to life.
Well, can you imagine being an adult person going through life with the name Bunny?
No, but I'm sure. Haven't you had childhood friends who had, you know, silly names that they
they
just stuck with as their real names. She could have changed her name at any point. Her mother was called Rachel, and Bunny at birth was named Rachel, and her nurse said she looks like an adorable little bunny, and that's how she got the name. And this was a family with a lot of nicknames. Her brother was Gerard Jr., but he became Sonny. Her son was Stacy Lloyd III. He became known as Tuffy for Tough Baby. In the Muffies and the Buffies of the world, I guess this is not that unusual.
I want to follow up with their relationship with Jackie Kennedy. After the assassination of President Kennedy, did they stay friends? Did she stay close with Jackie for the rest of her life?
Yes, I mean they were soulmates. I mean, that's what even Caroline Kennedy said to me. Lee Radziwill, Jackie's sister, said to me, they had a wonderful time together. They joked, they laughed, they read books, they went to the theater, they went to ballet, they traveled together all the time. Bunny did encourage Jackie to marry Ario Nossis, which may not have been her best bit of advice, but she thought that he would provide Jackie with emotional and financial security, and certainly there was financial security. And Bunny was by Jackie's side when she died. I mean, she was her best friend.
And Carolyn Kennedy continued to have a relationship with her as though she were her aunt?
Absolutely. Caroline went to, you know, all of Bunny's major occasions. When Bunny turned 100, when Bunny's daughter died, Caroline was there. She was very much a rock for Bunny, and Bunny just adored her.
Oh, yeah. So tell us a little bit about, you know, she spent years with her daughter. What was the situation there?
Her daughter, Eliza Moore, really talented artist, very independent streak. She had married in 1968 and eventually got divorced and came out as gay and had, you know, a longtime woman companion. And they didn't always get along, but they were really pretty close. And Eliza was crossing the street in New York, and a truck didn't see her and barreled into her. She hit her head badly. She had recently changed addresses, and so her license didn't reflect where she was. And she spent 24 hours at St. Vincent's Hospital, in which nobody knew who she was, and the doctors decided she was brain dead and chose not to operate. And by the time Bunny and family members found out, it was essentially too late. They won a massive malpractice lawsuit against St. Vincent's, but Eliza, she couldn't speak, she couldn't walk, she couldn't feed herself. It was a very sad situation. Bunny tried everything. She moved Eliza back to her farm. She had every variety of therapist, and Eliza never spoke again, but she did live for 8 years. And so what amazed me in reading Bunny's correspondence during that period is, I mean, that kind of experience is just beyond heartbreaking. It would be almost impossible not to become severely depressed. And yet, Bunny always took joy in nature. And she wrote these wonderfully lyrical letters about, you know, whether it was sitting in Eliza's room, listening to classical music, but looking outside the window and seeing the dew on the grass or the snow on the trees or the deer. There was something about she could, you know, it was funny because she had all the money in the world, and yet here was this connection to the world around her, the natural world, you know, the birds and the trees, flowers, that made her feel like she could get up every morning and face the day.
Well, Meryl Gorton, I should say that your book, Bunny Mellon, The Life of an American Style Legend, is punctuated with lovely little drawings. Can you say something about those?
When I was reading through Bunny's correspondence, she always illustrated her letters, and in fact, she and Jackie had taken art lessons together, and she always had a little sketchbook out. And when I finished the book, I suddenly had this brainstorm. I thought, sketches. No one has ever seen them, and they're so lovely. And I asked the estate, would they be open to letting me use them in the book? And they said yes, and my publisher said yes, and therefore I was able to illustrate every chapter with one of Bunny's drawings. And it was really fun to try to match up the topic, as in when the Queen comes to visit or when Princess Di comes to visit, and when I found little crowns that Bunny had sketched, I thought, oh, this is perfect. It felt like I was able to use her voice in the book through her letters and her journals, and I also felt I was able to show her creativity through these sketches.
It's a great book. I really love it. I mean, it's kind of a mammoth book. I mean, it's a lot different, I think, than writing an article for Vanity Fair. How do you approach this long life and writing this massive book about it?
It was hard because, I mean, I was very lucky in that I had so much material. I mean, every time I would go to Bunny's farm and library, I would just Xerox like an insane person. Then I would come back and try to figure out where everything worked. And I kind of wanted to write this as if it were a novel, but everything was true. I mean, you know, I didn't make anything up. All the quotes are from Bunny or from people I interviewed. So I was hoping to, you know, write it that you could feel the drama, that you could feel what was going on in Bunny's life. The only thing that was funny about when you write about somebody who lives till 103 years old, normally you get into somebody's 80s, their lives aren't that interesting. But when I got up to Bunny's 80s, it was like, oh my God, I have three more chapters left. I still have the whole John Edwards scandal. I have various other things in her life. So that she was interesting up to the last second.
Well, you are sort of a recognized expert on elder abuse, and you mentioned your book about Brooke Astor that detailed some of that. And so Bunny Mellon was, you've alluded to, sort of preyed upon by John Edwards. Would you say preyed upon is right?
Well, there were actually two things. She was preyed upon by her accountant, who stole a lot of money from a lot of people, including roughly $18 million from Bunny and her son. So that was she didn't know that was happening. She was distraught. She had really trusted this man he'd worked for years. So that was, you know, that was a shock to her. With John Edwards, it's complicated. She was so excited about being relevant. She loved the idea of electing a president. She really felt engaged. She felt a sense of mischief. And he, you know, he called her before debates. He went to visit her. She felt very excited and, you know, happy about the experience. And she never felt angry even after the trial and the whole thing. She kept saying to people, didn't we have fun? But there are people who, you know, yes, think that John Edwards took advantage of an elderly woman who was besotted with him. But to his credit, I will say, even after everything was over, the trial was over, there was nothing left to be gained, he stayed in touch with Bunny. He called her. The last weekend before she died, she wanted to talk to him. And so he maintained a friendship, a connection with her, which he didn't have to do, and that mattered to her a lot.
So you could give him the benefit of the doubt on this thing?
I could say that he behaved honorably towards her, at least at the end.
But the lawyer who stole from her, and he's a sort of...
Accountant,
just disappeared with all of her money. Did he get away with it? Did he get caught?
No. He spent a number of years in jail, just got out last year at some point. But he stole from many famous people, and kind of notorious for, you know, Carly Simon was one of the people who, the singer, there were all sorts of very famous... Uma Thurman was one of the people who accused him. A lot of famous people were taken advantage of by... his name is Ken Starr, but he's not the Whitewater Ken Starr.
Oh, he's a different Ken Starr.
Yes.
And he appears in your book, you know, pretty early on. You don't kind of suspect that he's going to be this guy.
Well, you know, one of the things you learn about writing these books is you have to put a little breadcrumbs in there so that when you finally get to the point where someone turns up, you're like, oh, my God, here was this mild-mannered person. I had no idea. But you don't want to just spring everything at once, I've discovered. I have to have suspense.
And you do, and it does really read like a novel. And the book is called Bunny Mellon, The Life of an American-Style Legend. And the author, New York Times bestselling author, my guest, Meryl Gordon. Thank you, Meryl Gordon, for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being such a knowledgeable host.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. Check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Joe Hagan, author of Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine, and Merrill Gordon, author of Bunny Melon, The Life of an American Style Legend. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.